Hello, and welcome to Natural News. I'm Kim McCurdy. In this half hour, I'm going to be reading articles that pertain to all things natural, and hopefully we can live a little more naturally. Let's get started today with Mother Earth Living, Natural Home, Healthy Life. This is from the May-June 2019 issue, and this article is entitled, broad category, Health Solutions. Its main title is Telemedicine 101, What You Need to Know. Learn about a growing virtual healthcare system that has the potential to offer fast, inexpensive medical service. Does Skyping your doctor for your next appointment sound like a stretch? It might not be for long. Telemedicine is taking off, and its growing popularity has the potential to guide the future of healthcare in a completely new direction. Many people are wondering whether telemedicine is a solution for their needs, especially with its promise of faster and cheaper health care. Let's look at what virtual health technology can provide and evaluate the benefits and concerns of this expanding industry. What is telemedicine? Telemedicine is broadly defined as any professional communication between a doctor and their patient when they aren't in the same physical location. Through technology, such as cell phones and the internet, healthcare professionals can virtually evaluate, diagnose, and prescribe treatments to their patients. Many companies offer 24/7 access to doctors for professional medical advice, and some maintain contracts with specialists from around the world. Rural medical practices, in particular, can use telemedicine to receive outside counsel during emergencies, or reach more people in isolated areas. Thanks to smartphones, the barriers for using telemedicine are disappearing. This makes virtual health care a more feasible option in patients' homes, assisted living facilities, and other locations where traditional medical care may be inconvenient. Today, the technology is used to diagnose ailments such as colds, skin rashes, allergies, asthma, mental illness, lower back pain, urinary tract infections, diabetes, and hypertension. Virtual medicine's history and growth. References to telemedicine in the medical world first began in the 1950s, when Pennsylvania medical staff transmitted radiologic images through telephones. But experiments within the space program are responsible for catapulting virtual medicine forward. NASA used telemedicine throughout the 1960s to monitor astronauts' health while they were in space, including during the first moon landing in 1969. Even so, virtual medicine equipment was still too complex to be practical for home visits, at least until common use of the internet. In recent years, remote medical service has increasingly become part of the mainstream healthcare system. A 2017 survey reports that about 75% of the medical providers who responded now offer or plan to offer some form of telemedicine. In 2012, the American Telemedicine Association estimated that there were approximately 200 telemedicine networks and 3,500 service sites across the country. That's not to say the practice is ubiquitous. One survey shows that close to 40% of Americans haven't heard of telemedicine, and another states that only 15% of surveyed physicians regularly use telehealth services within a 12-month window. However, a third poll shows that almost 90% of Americans age 40 and older have reported they would be willing to use it. But telemedicine's influence isn't just within the United States. The global telemedicine industry is expected to be valued at almost $80 billion by 2020. Advantages of telemedicine. Is an internet-based doctor's appointment more appealing than a traditional one? For many, the answer is yes. One report shows that most respondents express satisfaction after using telemedicine for their medical care. Another study reported that participants ranked telemedicine as non-inferior to in-person services, were more satisfied by the convenience of telemedicine, and were satisfied with the quality of communication and competence of the physician. Other factors may also contribute to telemedicine's attractiveness for patients. Long wait times and rushed appointments at a doctor's office may make some patients willing to try telemedicine, especially for minor recurring ailments. Many telemedicine platforms also offer options for 24/7 non-emergency medical consultations that make it easy to receive an expert opinion while avoiding the high fees related to on-site urgent care treatment. For instance, each virtual visit typically costs less than $50, as opposed to $100 to $150 for in-person or urgent care visits. Likewise, when travel time isn't an issue, patients can more easily fit doctor's appointments into their busy schedules, leading to less missed work time. Staying away from hospitals also reduces patients' exposure to other illnesses during a visit. Patients aren't the only ones who benefit from telemedicine. The practice seems to make sense for doctors, too. Health practitioners may be able to lower their costs with remote diagnosis. Video appointments typically shorten the time of each visit, allowing doctors to see more patients per day. Telemedicine may also reduce the instances of no-shows and cancellations because the appointments are more convenient for patients to keep. Specialty care and virtual medicine. Telemedicine also transforms traditional medical services by improving patient access to specialty care. The technology is ideal for psychiatry because it allows specialists to work virtually with patients far beyond their geographic range. Areas with a health professional shortage have just one provider for every 30,000 or more U.S. citizens. However, video visits can increase opportunities for people, especially in these high-need areas, to receive treatment. Additionally, telemedicine is improving access to specialty care for inmates. Most prisons are located in rural areas, far from cancer and heart treatment centers, and securely transporting inmates to a physical office is expensive. According to a 2011 survey from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, 30 of the 45 states polled reported that they use telemedicine for part of their prison health care process, primarily for psychiatry and cardiology treatment. Telemedicine concerns. Despite telemedicine's rapid expansion, critics are questioning whether the practice makes sense in the long run. Some primary care providers fear that offering video visit services implies that their in-office care is lower quality than that of their physical office competition, potentially giving those competitors an edge. Access to technology can also be a hurdle. In most cases, setting up and using telemedicine platforms requires expensive training and equipment purchases. Though some secure video chat services work with a regular webcam. Standard video apps such as FaceTime and Skype aren't secure enough for medical visits, and regulatory issues may affect the effectiveness of available technology. Critics of telemedicine also worry that receiving advice from a doctor whom you've never met in person will prevent you from receiving personalized quality care. Some research backs up these concerns. A published study found that in 62 telemedicine encounters, one-third or less of them offered patients a choice between doctors, disclosed the clinician's credentials, or discussed common side effects of prescribed medication. Some also misdiagnosed conditions because they failed to ask the right follow-up questions. Setting telemedicine standards. To combat these concerns, the American Telemedicine Association, www.americantelemed.org, and other organizations have started accreditation programs that help patients identify the best telemedicine providers. Likewise, the American Medical Association, www.ama-assn.org, provides ethical guidelines for telemedicine care that call for doctors to recognize their limits and to ensure that they have as much information about every patient as possible before making recommendations. Creating this connection between physician and patient may include a face-to-face examination, either in person or through real-time video calls, a consultation with a physician who has established an ongoing relationship with the patient, or a commitment to meet established telemedicine guidelines for patient-physician relationships. Even so, there's little overall agreement about what the limits of virtual medicine are, leaving some diagnoses up to the discretions of different medical companies. The telemedicine industry also needs to establish standards for who will pay for these services. Insurance coverage and reimbursement rates for telemedicine vary on a state and supplier level, and existing federal plans only cover a small number of services. At present, 32 states have parity laws that require private insurers to reimburse doctors for remote treatment if the same service would otherwise be covered for an in-person visit. Some states have also joined a compact that allows doctors licensed in one state to obtain a license in another, making it easier for specialists to treat patients in participating states. The level of reimbursement can vary across states, though most come close to the reimbursement rates for in-person visits. National programs are also slow to adapt. Medicare will cover only a few telemedicine services, and the regulations for Medicaid vary considerably by state. Most cover telemedicine in some capacity, but the rules and requirements vary considerably. Telemedicine has a bright future, but whether it becomes better accepted depends on how regulators, providers, and physicians address some of these challenges it currently faces. If you are willing to experiment with virtual medicine, you might be amazed by how it improves your healthcare quality, costs, and efficiency this year. The author is Lydia Noyes and is a freelance writer and hobby farmer on a 33-acre property in western Michigan. You can find her online at www.firstrootsfarm.com. Couple of inset articles. One, learn more. How telemedicine works. Telemedicine today uses technology to simplify health care for both patients and providers. Most visits rely on the internet to transmit voices, images, and/or video from the patient to the doctor. There are three main ways that telemedicine is used. Store and forward. This method works as a secure email system to share private patient data online without compromising it. Store and forward works best in situations that don't call for a real-time conversation, such as a clinic sharing x-rays with a remote specialist for diagnosis. Remote monitoring. This technique allows physicians to monitor a patient's vital signs off-site through specialty tracking tools, such as phone apps, mobile medical devices, and wearables. Remote monitoring is typically used to manage chronic conditions, including diabetes. Interactive services. These services provide face-to-face interactions in real time between the doctor and patient, often to diagnose and prescribe treatment within a virtual visit. Secure video calls are a classic example of interactive telemedicine. Good to know, telemedicine versus telehealth. While the terms telemedicine and telehealth are often used interchangeably, they don't mean the same thing, and it's helpful to know the difference. Telehealth is a broad categorization for all technology used within the healthcare industry, including staff training opportunities, administrative meetings, and public awareness campaigns. Telemedicine, in contrast, refers only to the use of electronic communication for providing clinical services to patients without an in-person appointment. Staying with the same issue of the magazine of Mother Earth Living, we'll go to an article entitled Sort the Green from the Garbage. Empower your homemaking decisions by learning about the everyday items that wind up in landfills, or worse, and the easy swaps you can make to become a more conscientious consumer. This is by Nicole Caldwell. Let's say you're a level 2 eco warrior. Maybe you've been composting for a while, eat a plant-based diet, and have a bicycle basket loaded with mesh produce bags and cloth shopping totes for items not already grown in your garden. What then to do with the waste that still piles up around your home? Even the most eco-conscious among us make daily decisions about a seemingly perpetual stream of trash that feels unavoidable and impossible to dispose of properly. For folks who have already taken steps to live green, here's the next phase of self-examination. We're talking clothing, toothbrushes, shampoo bottles, and cotton swabs, just to name a few. As your tinfoil tube grows leaner and your plastic toothbrushes fray, consider this guide for low-waste replacements. Fads fade, but clothing lives on. Time to decompose. Nylon fabric, 30 to 40 years. Cotton shirt, 1 to 6 months. Wool clothing, including socks, 1 to 5 years. Polyester fabric, 20 to 200 years. The textile industry is second only to the petroleum industry as the world's biggest polluter. Pesticides have become ubiquitous in cotton fabric production, not to mention the water waste. It can take 713 gallons of water to make a single cotton t-shirt. Meanwhile, production of artificial materials, such as nylon, releases large amounts of nitrous oxide, which is 300 times worse for the atmosphere than carbon dioxide. Further, chemical-laden dyes wreak havoc in waterways, and the international transportation of goods creates a massive carbon footprint. Once you bring an item home, thousands of microfibers and larger bits of man-made materials shed during every regular wash cycle, and even more during decomposition when an item is thrown away. One 2018 study found 73% of fish caught at mid-level depths in the Atlantic Ocean, for example, had microplastics in their bellies. The wastefulness of fast fashion only exacerbates the aforementioned problems. Only natural materials, plant-based cotton, hemp, and linen, animal-based wools, leathers, and furs, all undergo biotic decomposition. Meanwhile, clothes advertised as recycled can come from companies that buy unused bottles from manufacturers to then make polyester clothing labeled recycled. Alternatives. Even when shopping at thrift stores, which do great work to keep fabrics out of landfills and prolong the shelf life of individual pieces, keep an eye out for organic cottons and other natural fibers. The easiest solution? Invest in a capsule wardrobe, a small collection of timeless essential pieces that can be tailored to fit and last a lifetime. Choose local brands with a sustainability mission. You may pay more up front, but if you limit your wardrobe to a few great pieces that will last your lifetime, you'll save thousands in the long run. Clean out the cotton swabs. Time to decompose. Cotton tips, 5 to 6 months. The plastic stick, about 20 years. As with cotton balls, just about every bathroom has cotton swabs, and we take for granted how wasteful they can be. Cotton swabs are biodegradable only if they're made from 100% cotton and cardboard, although even then the cotton is often produced with high volumes of pesticides and water. And a lot of people flush the swabs when they're finished using them, which means they end up in sewage systems that can overflow with heavy rainfall and leave the sticks along riverbeds, beaches, and inland bodies of water. In the United Kingdom, cotton swab sticks account for 60% of sewage-related beach trash. And actually, cotton swabs may be entirely unnecessary. The human body is designed to produce and regulate its own earwax, which keeps bad things, bacteria, bugs, water, out. Just about every other use for a cotton swab has an easy replacement. Alternatives. For ear care, check out a bamboo ear pick. For nails and makeup, use small cut pieces of rag. For cleaning around the house, utilize discarded toothbrushes and strips of rags for hard-to-reach places. And for the cotton swabs you've already got at home, go ahead and use them. Just make sure they end up in a garbage pail, not the toilet. The dirty truth about toothbrushes. Time to decompose? 20 to 1,000 years. The American Dental Association recommends that toothbrushes be replaced when bristles become misshapen and frayed, generally every 3 to 4 months. Because toothbrushes are largely plastic-based, that's an awful lot of petroleum used in production, and a huge volume of pollution when the tiny implements find their way not to landfills, but to beaches, oceans, and public waterways. The plastic that winds up deep in the ocean goes unexposed to photodegradation, meaning entire toothbrushes float in the sea and often end up being consumed by marine life. The data site, Statista, found that approximately 329.26 million people in the United States use manual toothbrushes in 2018. Accounting for conservatively timed replacements of every 4 months, the number of manual toothbrushes used and theoretically discarded last year spikes to 1.3 billion. If you're thinking electric toothbrushes are any better, think again. Batteries pose a host of environmental issues, and the lion's share of those brushes are also petroleum-based. While strides have been made to create brushes from recycled materials, manufacture replaceable brush heads, or even offer 100% compostable toothbrushes, we've yet to arrive at a truly universal zero-waste product to clean teeth daily. Alternatives: avoid the plastic waste of toothbrushes by purchasing biodegradable options, or brushes made of recyclable materials with replaceable heads. Some electric and manual brushes come in silicone, which is non-toxic and more environmentally friendly than traditional plastics. Instead of traveling with a plastic toothbrush holder, consider a washcloth or a container made of stainless steel or silicone. Nothing clean about shampoo and conditioner bottles. Time to decompose? 70 to 450 years. Plastic bottles are the second slowest plastic item to decompose. And yet, even as we eschew plastic water bottles for reusable ones, there's still widespread use of plastic containers for juice, iced tea, liquor, cosmetics, deodorant, and of course shampoo and conditioner. 1 million plastic bottles are purchased every minute around the world. And while many plastic containers in the kitchen get recycled, almost half of all Americans never recycle personal care products, which can result in up to 552 million plastic bottles in landfills or waterways. What you may not know is that there's a plethora of new zero-waste shampoos and conditioners and other personal care items on the market. You just may have to order them online or find a local specialty store, co-op, or organic market. Alternatives: invest in shampoo and conditioner bars or make your own. When you make the switch, prepare for a short transition period while your scalp's oil production adjusts to the shampoo and conditioner bars. Your hair may become more oily or dry during this period. Once your scalp gets back to its normal pH, you'll find the bars work well for all types of hair. When traveling, use a washcloth or old metal tin for transport. For your existing personal care items, add a recycling bin to your bathroom to make it easy to get those containers headed in the right direction. Don't be fooled by foil. Time to decompose? Up to 400 years. Certain household swaps, such as rags for paper towels and glass or steel for plastic leftover containers, can be performed with relative ease. Aluminum foil, on the other hand, is one of the most difficult household items to do without. That's because so many cooking techniques require items to be covered. Grilling outside is also notoriously synonymous with aluminum foil for everything from vegetables to meats. And we haven't even gotten to storing leftovers or protecting toaster or toaster oven trays. What you may not know is that it takes about 170 million British thermal units to produce 1 ton of aluminum, with 12 million tons of greenhouse gases as byproducts. Many people reuse their foil, which is obviously a plus after such a wasteful manufacturing process. But the other end of foil's life is just as bad. There's plenty of evidence showing aluminum foil's proclivity for a negative impact on human and marine life, including contributing to eutrophication, a nutrient-caused water pollution that can result in algal blooms that kill fish and other aquatic life. Alternatives: First and foremost, find a transfer station that accepts cleaned aluminum foil for recycling. When you're ready to make the switch, check out silicone pie shields, casserole dishes with lids, inverted cookie sheets for simple coverage while baking, a stainless steel vegetable basket for grilling, and a cookie sheet under uncovered potatoes for baking. E-waste is built to last forever. Time to decompose? Does not decompose. Even landfills don't want broken electronics, e-waste, which are arguably the most durable items out there in terms of potential to decompose, or lack thereof. From the glass to the neodymium iron boron magnet in a hard disk head, more likely to pollute everything around it than ever to break down, e-waste was designed for all time, even if its components were built for planned obsolescence. Besides the host of harmful byproducts that goes along with the manufacturing of these products, there's the heavy toll we pay once they wind up in landfills and the toxic waste leaks out. Nationwide, e-waste accounts for just 2% of landfill trash by volume and a shocking 70% of total toxic waste. Alternatives. Recycle all e-waste, limit how much you end up with, and make sure to do your research to find legitimate, sustainable recycling companies when it's time to retire a device. Always try to fix electronics and sell them back to manufacturers or buyers before turning them in on sanctioned e-waste disposal days. Never put e-waste in regular trash. The statistics are dizzying, but for each of these hard-to-escape environmental offenses, there are a host of alternatives. With knowledge comes agency and, equally as important, choice. As consumers, we can choose to invest our money in products built to last in our homes, not in landfills. Select materials that don't cause undue harm to the environment, and empower yourself with switches that don't require purchasing anything at all. Learn more. All rot is not created equal. Public perception of plastic is shifting, but it's not universal just yet. Meanwhile, every piece of plastic ever created is still in existence, and the vast majority of that will outlast every one of us. It can take up to 1,000 years for some kinds of plastic, such as bags, to decompose, and even then they'll never biodegrade. Biodegradation, or biotic decomposition, is the product of biological activity, especially when microorganisms consume something and transform it into something else. On the other hand, abiotic decomposition is the act of something physically breaking down into smaller pieces of itself, such as a glass bottle and the ocean gradually becoming tiny bits of sea glass. That's an important distinction. While everything will eventually break down, even if it takes thousands of years, there's a big difference between plant matter nourishing soil and plastic bags slowly breaking into ever tinier pieces, only to absorb toxins from waterways and then be consumed by animals, often harming them in the process. Products such as plastic shopping bags made from polyethylene don't get gobbled up by microbes. Instead, they're left to lose their elasticity and durability as UV rays slowly eat away at them. We actually don't know how long they'll be around. Well, that's all the time we have. You've been listening to Natural News. I'm Kim McCurdy. As always, thanks for listening.